Our guest today, Carolyn Engelhard, a woman with many titles, more titles than most people could actually fit onto a business card. True or not true, Carolyn?
True.
Director of the Health Policy Program, Department of Public Health Sciences, from the University of Virginia School of Medicine.
True.
All true.
True.
And I hope so, because I think I copied that off your email letter that we exchanged.
I know. That's right. Truth in advertising.
We are going to be talking about current issues to do with the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, some of the politics that go with that, some of the numbers that have come around in the last bit of time. Because you can now enroll, right? The window is now open again.
Correct. November 1st through January 31.
So we'll be talking all about that throughout the hour. The phone line will be open. I'll take calls in a little bit. 284-9470. 284-9470. Write that down. 284-9470. This is WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. All right, so Carolyn, let's show your expertise.
Okay, Rick.
I'd like to know, have you explained the difference between the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question, and I would say that initially Obamacare was used as a slur. It is kind of comical that John Boehner, he's gone now, Speaker of the House, wants to patent Obamacare so that he can then use it when he writes books and things like that. But the Obama administration, after initially saying that Obamacare, or they never really came out and said anything, but then after a while actually embraced it. So Obamacare, when it was first put out there, was meant to be critical, meant to be a slur, much like Hillary Care was for the Clinton health care plan in the early 1990s. But the Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, are the same plan. But if you ask Americans if they like Obamacare, public opinion surveys say no. And if you ask them if they like the Affordable Care Act, more will say yes. So perception is reality. And, you know, partisan ideology is rampant, even subliminally. So I think that's the difference in the ACA and Obamacare, which is to say that there is no difference except in the minds of people who hear those two words.
How, I mean, we talk about that, or you talk about that as the slur, the difference in terms of how people define it. I guess their own sort of mental image mm-hmm. about that. When you talk about this, because this is your specialty, right? This is what you do, or certainly have been doing for quite a number of years now. It's going around explaining to people the definitions of things, how it works, fact versus fiction.
Correct. In fact, I wrote a book. I co-wrote a book in 2008 called Healthcare Half-Truths, Too Many Myths, Not Enough Reality. So yeah, this is who I am. This is what I do all the time.
Do you still find people who say, you know, no, that's a bunch of bull. That's not true. That's not what I read.
About Obamacare, about the
ACA? Or about any part of it.
Yes. Well, what I find is that when you talk about healthcare policy or our healthcare system, very quickly people's eyes glaze over because it is so very complicated and people like things simple. So, you know, there is that mnemonic, keep it simple, stupid, KISS, which is important because if you can't translate information to people, to my students, for example, they will just go blank. And people really need to understand so that they can become informed citizens and decide whether or not they want a health care system that the Affordable Care Act espouses, or whether they want a different kind of health care system. But they need to know the difference if they're going to make an intelligent choice.
It has become so, okay, so let me ask you these, and then I'll make my comment, because okay. I realized I was going to give the answer away. A few fact versus fiction questions for the expert here today as we talk about the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion. Carolyn Engelhardt, she is the director of the health policy program at UVA School of Medicine. Fact versus fiction. The Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, which I will call it that repeatedly throughout the hour because that's what people
think of it as.
Mm-hmm,
sure.
Confusing or not? Fact versus fiction.
The fact is it is confusing, just as our healthcare system is confusing.
Is it partisan? Fact or fiction?
The Obamacare?
Yes.
Yes, I would agree it is partisan insofar that it is the only piece of major social legislation. So think of Medicare, Social Security, big pieces of social policy that affect many, many Americans over time. The Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, was the only piece of major social policy in this country that was not passed with one opponent vote. Not one Republican voted for it through its whole evolution through Congress, except for Senator Olympia Snowe in the Senate Finance Committee, just to get it out of committee before it could go to the full Senate for a vote. That was the lone Republican vote for a year. And ultimately, when it passed through a very convoluted way through Congress in 2010, not one Republican voted for it. So that in and of itself suggests that it's very partisan.
Is it partisan in the way that it works for the individual? It takes care of the poor, weak Democrat versus the rich Republican.
Right. Well, to the extent that we can stereotype Democrats as poorer than Republicans who are richer, the ACA definitely has winners and losers. Who are the winners? The winners are the millions of Americans who didn't work for a company that offered health insurance, that made less than about $30,000 a year, and who were traditionally uninsured. Now, what we know in this country, which is really interesting if you think about it, what differentiates us from other developed nations is poor people in the United States don't vote. So policies that benefit the poor often don't get a lot of support on Capitol Hill because the beneficiaries of those policies don't vote. So the winners under the ACA are people who had been uninsured for a long time, childless adults who were low income, who were ineligible for traditional Medicaid, and older people, the 54 to 64-year-olds who may have retired early or been out of a job, but because of their age, health insurance was much more expensive. For those folks, the ACA has actually helped because it reduced the premium difference among young people and old people. So those are the winners. Who are the losers? The losers are young, healthy Americans who heretofore, before the ACA, were able to buy bare bones policies that excluded lots of benefits they didn't want, and were able to get it at a pretty cheap price. Those folks are losers. They pay 2 to 3 times as much for health insurance as they do under the ACA. Are relatively young, higher income individuals more Republican leaning? I don't know. But there are winners and losers under Obamacare, And it breaks down along gender. Women before the ACA were charged more for health insurance. It breaks lines along age. The older were charged more before. Now they can't be charged as much more. And by income. So whether or not those are Democrats versus Republicans, I'm not sure.
Our guest today on the Wake Up Call, Carolyn Engelhard. She's the director of the health policy program at UVA School of Medicine. It is 11:10 here at WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, 94.7. Carolyn, let me ask you a couple questions. The reason I wanted to do the fact versus fiction. You know, I'm trying to do my homework before the program, and because as I asked, it's confusing. It's a confusing amount of information to learn. It's a ton of information to learn. It's very confusing as to what's true and what's false. And if you try and Google it, forget about it, because whatever comes up seems to be completely one-sided. And I'm not sure it even matters whether you think you're reading something that's accurate or not. Maybe if I found Carolyn Engelhard's book, I could find that to be faithful and trustworthy bits of information. But many people, maybe not listeners to this radio station, would say that if I went to the whitehouse.gov site, that that's one-sided. If I went to PolitiFacts, that's one-sided. If I went to Fox News, that's one-sided. And I'm never, or how do I get a fully rounded bit of information that tells me what works for me? I mean, you just mentioned, or you just told some story about how those who did win and lose with the installation of the Affordable Care Act, but where do I find that on the internet, which is the general place people are going? Or who do I go sit across from? Because I'm assuming that of the 100,000 plus people in our area, you don't have time to sit down with them all. Where do I go to gather a fair contact with to find this information out?
Right. That's a great question. And I think each of us, even if we try very hard to be completely neutral, none of us are completely without our particular lens or biases. The biggest compliment my students can give me is if they tell me they don't know how I vote or how I will vote when an election comes up. So what I try and do is triangulate. I read both conservative group articles about the ACA. So by conservative, I would say the Heritage Foundation, American Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute, they're a libertarian group. And then I go to more liberal-leaning groups like the Commonwealth Fund, Families USA. And then I go to the government to actually get the statistics. I mean, the enrollment figures. Who's enrolled in the ACA? Who's still uninsured? What are the ages? And then I try to read peer-reviewed articles, academic articles about more to look at those figures and then to better understand, well, what does that mean as far as 19 to 34-year-olds, young adults, what's happening with them? Because they were the group the ACA wanted to attract the most. What's happened to them? So I try to go everywhere, and as you triangulate, certain things remain at the top. And then you feel like there's some certitude that that's true and real.
So let's jump into some of the questions that you just stated you ask yourself when you do your research.
Okay.
Who has enrolled?
So,
who enrolled first? Who enrolled first? Is there a process by those who you found, these people jumped at it, jumped right at the opportunity, and then others have trickled.
Sure. So imagine who would want health insurance? Well, the answer is people who are going to need it, people who anticipate using health care. If you have a chronic illness, if you're diabetic, if you're hypertensive, if you've got a chronic disease, you know you're going to go to the doctor. You know you're going to need health insurance. Those are the first people who didn't have health insurance before who are going to flock to the Affordable Care Act, especially if you're lower income. And so right now, we're moving into the 2016 enrollment period. So we've had 2 full years of the ACA, a.k.a. Obamacare. Who has signed up? Well, a total of about 9 million people on the exchanges. I don't want to confuse your listeners too much by going too much into the weeds, but people.
They're a smart group.
Okay, so you probably remember that states had the option to set up their own exchange, or if they didn't, they would default to the federal exchange. Most states did not set up their own exchange. Only 13 plus the District of Columbia did, and the rest defaulted to the federal exchange. And those two different vehicles, state exchange, federal exchange, there's about 9 million folks that signed up through the exchanges. Of those, about 80%, 8 out of 10, received a significant subsidy to help them buy health insurance. So what does that tell us? Tells us the people who got through the healthcare.gov debacle the first year, who stuck with it, are people who needed health insurance and who knew they would get a sizable subsidy to help them buy it.
So poor people mm-hmm. people couldn't afford it and needed health care.
Right. So those are the ones who signed up through the exchange. There is the Medicaid expansion, which was part of the ACA, but the Supreme Court decided in 2012 that states could optionally offer the Medicaid expansion. Medicaid expansion was for low-income folks, regardless of their category. Traditional Medicaid covers only certain people, covers poor children, poor pregnant women, the disabled, and the poor, frail elderly. That's it. If you're a childless adult, you could have zero income, you could live on a grate, under a bridge, and you still wouldn't be eligible for Medicaid in most states. So what the Medicaid expansion did was say, look, we know that the 40 plus million people who are uninsured fall into this category of being poor people who don't fit the categories of children, pregnant women, disabled, poor, elderly. And we're going to cover them under the ACA. And so for the states that took advantage of the Medicaid expansion, they've reduced their uninsured by about 50%. And the states that haven't, like Virginia, they've reduced their uninsured by much less. But under the Medicaid expansion, there are now 14 million new people covered nationwide. So you add that to the 9 million through the exchanges, and you can see there's about 23 million newly insured folks.
Out of how many?
Oh, well, we started out in the low 40 millions. Now the remaining uninsured is about 33 million people in the U.S.
So you're saying we've insured in how many years now? Two years?
Two
years. In 2 years, we have insured
23 million, but not all of them are brand new. What most experts say is about 16.4 million are insured now that would have been uninsured had the ACA not passed.
Okay. So let me back up and do it in the way that my brain is asking for it to function. Before the Affordable Care Act started,
right,
we had how many people uninsured?
About 45 million.
Okay. And how many of those people are currently insured now that the Affordable Care Act has begun?
16 million.
So we still have
about 33 million uninsured.
33 million people uninsured.
Mm-hmm.
And are those people uninsured, or do we have numbers and we need to take a break? So we'll do that right after this. How many of those people, do we have it broken down into percentages or segments of how many are uninsured out of choice because they don't want to pay their dollars per month because they're young and would rather keep it for rent or money or parties?
Yep.
And yes, how many, it's just too expensive, even though I am, you know, old enough where I might have a health problem.
Yes, we do. We can talk about it now, or we can do it after the break. What do you say?
Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back. Our guest today, Carolyn Engelhardt, she's with UVA. She's the director of the health policy program at University School of Medicine.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel, with 6 area locations.
And here we are, 11:22, and it's a pretty day outside, 61 degrees here down near the station. You know, you're welcome to go onto the website and volunteer. We are looking for volunteers here at WPVC. You can find us WPVC.org. We'll start taking phone calls. I'm going to ask Carolyn to give the answers about the percentages to my question. You're welcome to call us up. 284-9470. If you have trouble remembering that, think of us as WPVC-947. So that's 284-9470. All right, back with Carolyn. So we were talking about the 33 million people who are still uninsured. How many of that is by personal choice? And then how many of that is, you know, I'm also curious as to how many of that is because the government, different state governments are saying, we're going to keep our own thing and it's too expensive. We're not going to do that federal government thing.
Right. So let me just walk us through this. It's hang in here with me. So of those 33 million currently uninsured, 7 million are undocumented immigrants. So they are ineligible for any sort of subsidy through the ACA. They basically can't go to the exchanges and, you know, get help buying health insurance. They are ineligible for the Medicaid expansion if they live in a state that's expanded their Medicaid. They are, so you have to just take them off the top.
So they will never be, so if we get down to 7 million undocumented immigrants, we will technically be at zero. Because that's as close as we're ever going to get.
Right. Now,
under current laws.
Correct. Now, some of those undocumented immigrants, as you know, have Social Security numbers. They pay taxes. They've been in this country for decades. Their children are American citizens. And they can go to a health insurance broker and they can buy health insurance. They just won't get any help if they are in an income that would give them a subsidy. But for the most part, you're exactly right, Rick. Those are, we sort of have to take them off the top and say, you know, we're never, it's going to be really hard to reach them.
Right, way the current laws are written.
Right. So the next 4 million are folks that we say are in the Medicaid expansion gap.
Ooh, the gap.
The gap, the coverage gap. So this is a really strange phenomenon. And what I teach my students is that every policy, every public policy has intended consequences and unintended consequences. And when you pull apart an extremely complicated law like the Affordable Care Act, you come up with some unintended consequences. So I mentioned people can go to these exchanges, federal or state, and get a subsidy to help them buy health insurance if they're certain income. That income spread is 100 to 400% of the federal poverty level. So if you're at 100%, you get a lot of help. And if you're at 400%, you get a little bit of help. But you can be in this situation where you are under 100% of the federal poverty level. Remember, I mentioned the childless adults that might have no money. But you might be a mom that has two kids, and you make $15,000 a year, and your children are eligible for Medicaid under the traditional program. They're poor children, low-income children. Your family income for three is less than 100% of the federal poverty level for three people. So I'm a mom. My kids are insured through Medicaid. My family household income is less than 100% of the federal poverty level. I get no help. I can't go to the exchange with a subsidy because I'm too poor for that subsidy. My neighbor might be a mom with two kids, and she might make $26,000 a year. She's above 100% of the federal poverty level for a family of three. Her kids are on Medicaid. She can go to the exchange, and she can get almost a free ride. I know that sounds crazy and counterintuitive, but that's the coverage gap. People who are too poor to get a subsidy on the exchange. And in Virginia, that's about 200,000 people. And then nationwide, that's almost 4 million. So of those 33 million people we're talking about, 4 million are in the coverage gap.
All right. So explain this to the stupid guy in the room, which is, how are you too poor? I mean, is it just poorly worded legislation? Did somebody in the, when they designed the website, forget to put the zero to, you know, to $10,000 income range in there and just put $10,000 to 14 or something? How can you be too poor?
Because the legislation assumed that the Medicaid expansion would go through. And those folks who are in the coverage gap would be covered under the Medicaid expansion if their states took advantage of it. So the 4 million people who are too poor are in states like Virginia who have not expanded their Medicaid, so that these folks do not qualify for traditional Medicaid, which I talked about as children, pregnant women, the disabled, the poor elderly, but they're too poor for the subsidies that begin at 100%. These 4 million people are only in those states that did not expand their Medicaid program, those 20 states that did not expand their Medicaid programs.
So am I, make sure that I'm interpreting this properly from a snide point of view, that there are states that did not expand their Medicaid program. The Virginia Republican legislature has created 200,000 families and individuals and
people,
folks,
yeah,
200,000 people who have no health insurance to prove a point.
So that's a, okay, so you've brought up, why would a state not expand their Medicaid program?
But there's also the other side of it, which is that at some point, can or who, can anyone go back and adjust the Affordable Care Act so that it doesn't start with a subsidy with a poverty level of 100%? Can you make it less than that?
Sure.
Is this a legislature issue so that it goes not only to the Virginia folks that we elect, but also to the federal government folks that we elect? Does that law need to be changed there?
Yes. Well, if you, certainly Congress could change the language in the Affordable Care Act such that, you know, everyone, all adults, not, you know, all adults would be eligible for subsidies beginning at 0% of the, you know, it, and
right, because
onward.
It goes to, what is the 138% or?
That's the Medicaid expansion.
Medicaid expansion.
But the subsidies on the exchanges are from 100% to 400%.
So it could be from 0 to 400%.
Could be from 0 to 400%. But that would mean that Obamacare would cost more, would require more tax dollars to pay for it.
So in order to get it passed mm-hmm. and paid for financially, they set it at 100%.
Because they thought that the folks below that would be picked up by the Medicaid expansion, which is, for the first 3 years, the federal government paid 100%, but after the first 3 years, the federal government and the state share it, although the federal government pays the lion's share into perpetuity. But, and the states will say that the reason they didn't expand their Medicaid program is twofold. One, they would say, is that even at the end of 10 years, when the state is only required to pay 30% of it, that that's still too much money. That states have to balance their budget, that if they have to pay that additional money for health coverage for their poorer citizens, then they won't be able to put it into education or roads or other sorts of things.
That's such crap. They don't put it into that now.
The second reason states say they have not expanded their Medicaid program is because they feel like Medicaid is a terrible program. They feel like it's too much government intervention, that it creates folks who are dependent on the government dole, and that why would they expand a program that they already don't like? So it is, that's the political explanation, and the economic explanation is that states feel they can't afford it. Now, 10 Republican governors in certain states have expanded their Medicaid program. John Kasich is one who's currently running for president on the Republican side. He would tell you, as would some other Republican governors who've expanded it, that it's good business, that hospitals do much better with Medicaid expansion. They don't treat as many indigent patients. They don't have as many uncompensated care costs. And that it stimulates growth for a state economy. The more people are insured, the healthier they are. It creates jobs for people. People move into the state. They buy things. So it's complicated, and it's very politicized.
11:32 here on the Wake Up Call. This is WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. Our guest today, Carolyn Engelhardt from UVA's School of Medicine, where she's the director of the Health Policy Program in the Department of Public Health Sciences. You're welcome to test out the phones, because, you know, I'm kind of nervous about the phones. 284-9470. That's WPVC 947. Whose phone number is 284-9470.
And let me just say to the listeners out there, I give lots of talks about the Affordable Care Act, and I tell my students, I tell everyone the same thing. There is no stupid question. This is a very complicated subject. I'm open to any of your questions, or if you have experiences with the healthcare system that surrounds the issues we've been talking about today, I welcome your reactions, feedback, and questions. This is how we become a more informed citizenry, which I think is really important. So let me just keep going down the 33 million without health insurance. So the next group are the young adults. There are 7.7 million people, individuals between 19 and 34 who do not have health insurance. Now, why is that important? Before the ACA was passed, the young adult cohort was the largest group of the uninsured, and they were also the healthiest. It's completely understandable. You graduate from college, you graduate from high school, you have your first job. Maybe you have college debt. You've got to pay your cell phone bill. You've got a car loan. If you're not sick, you think, you know, I don't get sick. Why should I pay X amount a month of money I really don't have for health insurance? So the ACA went after that group in two ways. One, by allowing young adults up to the age of 26 to stay on their parents' health insurance. And that has been extremely popular across the board with both Democrats and Republicans. There are about 3 million young adults at any given time who now have health insurance because they're on their parents' plan. I teach medical students, I teach graduate students, young graduate students. I almost always ask them, who in here has health insurance through their parents? And I'd say at least 2/3 of the students in my class raise their hands. So that was a big deal. They also, because they typically don't make a lot of money when they first get out of college, the idea was they would go to the exchange and be able to get health insurance with a subsidy. Well, a funny thing happened on the way to the exchange, and that is that many young adults still don't think it's affordable. Right now, there was a national survey done, and young adults were asked, how much can you afford to pay for health insurance? And the answer, the majority of the answers came in that they felt they couldn't pay more than $100 a month. Now, if you're not making a whole lot of money, you can go to the exchange and you can get a health insurance policy for less than $100 a month. You might have a fairly high deductible with it, but you can do that. But if you're a young adult and you make $30,000 a year or $40,000 a year, the subsidy you'll get to buy health insurance on the exchange becomes less and less. And it's probably more than $100 a month. So that group of people who are healthy and who the ACA really needs to be part of it in order to stabilize health insurance premiums for all the sick people who go in and buy health insurance because they know they need it, that 7.7 million people, young adults, have been very difficult to attract. And that is one of the main criticisms right now of the ACA is why the federal government now is doing all sorts of things to try to appeal to that group to bring them into the risk pool.
I thought that if they did not sign up, that they were penalized. And that was the other way to make sure that the pool was balanced in terms of money coming in versus money going out for the health insurance groups.
Bingo. Glad you mentioned that, Rick. So the first year of the ACA, the penalty was $95 or 1% of your income, whichever was higher. After the first year, that's really the only experience we know of because 2015 isn't over yet. We won't know how many people didn't have health insurance until they do their taxes, you know, April 2016, but from year one of the ACA, 7.5 million Americans paid penalties. And the penalties they paid were an average of about $200, although 40% of people's penalties were under $100. Now, every year, the penalties go up. For 2015, the penalty is $325, or 2% of your income, whichever is higher. And for 2016, it's $695 and 2.5% of your income, whichever is higher. So where is that point where people say, heck, I might as well just buy health insurance?
Well, is the penalty going up in order to force people to get health insurance?
Yes.
Is it doing so because the older crowd is only getting older and so they are using more of health insurance and the tests and the equipment and the billing that costs more money?
Well, the penalty is the same regardless of your age. I think that the statute was written such that the penalties continue to go up incrementally, because I think they think the first year people may not have heard about it. They don't understand it. Sort of a little grace period. Year two, you're punished a little more. Year three, you're punished more still. And the question then becomes, you know, it's sort of like if you want to go to the doctor and you've got a $10 copay, you might go, even if you just have a little bit of a cold, if the copay is $100, you might say, well, I'm going to wait and go to the doctor until I'm really pretty sick. It's that sense of people, you know, when it hurts you in your pocketbook more, you'll comply.
Our guest, Carolyn Engelhardt, here on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. This is WPVC 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Call us up, 284-9470.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning markets of Tiger Fuel, with 6 area locations.
And here we are back in action with Carolyn Engelhardt. You're welcome to call up and ask a question. I have tons of questions because I don't really understand the Affordable Care Act. I'm one of the few people, that's not fair to say, I'm one of the lucky people who work for an employer who offers me health insurance. Although, like many folks, just because I'm offered health insurance doesn't mean that it's inexpensive. I'm still paying a share, and when I look at what it costs me every month, I gag. But you're welcome to call up with your question for Carolyn, 284-9470. That's 284-9470 here at 94.7 WPVC. So let me ask you a couple of questions about the requirements of employers. Because I was always under the impression that one of the goals of the Affordable Care Act, of Obamacare, was to get employers to put their employees under health insurance. That was part of it, was let's make everybody a big, happy family. And come on now, employers, do your part, do your part. Get your employees under health insurance. You have... the larger the company, you're going to get a lower rate. So come on now. Come on now. Take advantage of that system and share the lower rate with everybody. But is that doesn't seem to be working. Or there are many ways in which that is not being used in that happy family system.
So the majority of Americans do receive health coverage through their jobs. 160 million of us get health care where we work. And the health coverage we receive at our jobs is very good. In fact, for those of your listeners who know about the different metal levels on the exchange under the ACA, the bronze, silver, gold, platinum, employer-sponsored health insurance tends to be in the gold range. So it's good. It's very good insurance. When the ACA was going forward, the architects of the legislation knew that to try to upset the health coverage vehicle for the majority of Americans would never work. So that's why they developed this sort of three-legged stool, if you will, of employer-sponsored insurance, the exchanges, and the Medicaid expansion. Those three legs of the stool was supposed to be able to bring in everybody. People with employer-sponsored insurance would keep theirs. If it was inadequate or not very good, then employers had to make it better according to a certain standard under the ACA. The Medicaid expansion would bring in those mostly childless adults who were who didn't get health insurance at their jobs, but all didn't fall into one of those traditional Medicaid categories. And then the exchange would appeal and be there for individuals who didn't get it through their jobs, who were ineligible for the Medicaid expansion because they weren't that poor, and yet they would be able to get a subsidy and buy health insurance. the employers, by and large, larger employers all offer health insurance. Most employers offer health insurance. The only folks who do not offer health insurance traditionally are the very, very small companies. Generally speaking, the larger the company, the better the benefits and the less expensive, because you can spread all of those overhead costs for insurance, enrollment costs, advertising, those sorts of things. If you have 1,000 employees, it's a lot cheaper than if you have 100 employees. So people were pretty happy with their employer-sponsored health coverage. And in fact, it's interesting because the ACA, you would think listening to the radio and listening to, you know, the talking heads on TV, that the ACA touched everybody. When in truth, 80% of Americans, listen to me, let me say that again, 80% of Americans' health coverage has not changed under the ACA.
When you say not changed, you're talking about the benefit itself. It still exists. You and I still have our health insurance, and the what we can do with it is still the same.
Correct.
But has the cost of it changed?
For some.
Has the network changed?
For some.
Do those, when you say that it hasn't changed for 80%, are you including that as part of the, I mean, if my health insurance went up $10, that's probably not the case. But certainly, I used to work for what would, I guess, be considered a larger company, a company that had 200 plus employees. And on a yearly basis, the human resources director had to sit down in November and December and go through and check and compare all the insurance companies. And some years it would stay the same. And some years we would, you know, for 2 or 3 years in a row, we'd get new cards, new company, new handbooks about, you know, and my dentist might change because they weren't in the network, et cetera, because of how the costs and benefits for the policy would change.
Right. Okay. Great question. So even before the ACA was passed, we would see yearly changes mm-hmm. in health insurance coverage. We have to remember that healthcare premiums, health insurance premiums, are tied to what we spend in our healthcare system. And for the last 30, 40 years, medical inflation, that is the rate of growth of health spending, has outpaced general inflation. So insurers and employers who buy insurance have had to figure out ways to reduce that cost increase to them. So they do it in a variety of ways. They increase deductibles, they raise premiums, they might change the network of providers, and so on. The ACA did influence that dynamic, but that dynamic is there no matter what. But the ACA did influence that dynamic because, as I mentioned before, there are winners and losers. And there are lots more fees and taxes in the ACA to pay for the ACA. It's $1 trillion over 10 years, $100 billion a year paid for through increases in fees insurance companies have to pay, fees pharmaceutical companies have to pay, increased payroll taxes for higher income Americans, and so on. The people who have to pay those taxes and fees aren't very happy about it, but the people who are enjoying having health insurance as a result of the ACA are grateful for it. So when I say the 80%, I mean 80%, the 80% who had health insurance before still have health insurance. I work for UVA. We have thousands of employees. We have very good health insurance. And I would say that over the last few years, my health insurance has gone up between 8 and 10% a year. That is a little bit a reflection of the ACA because of some of the fees, particularly the Cadillac tax coming down the pike that employers are worried about. But more so, I think it's just a reflection that healthcare spending is growing faster than the economy. So we can't attack, we can't criticize the healthcare spending or the premiums without also understanding what we're all doing to increase healthcare spending.
What would you say that your health insurance, and I use that as a generic, has increased 8 to 10% over the last few years? What do you believe that would have been a different percentage increase if the state of Virginia had passed the Medicaid expansion?
That's a good question. Probably not, because the healthcare spending would have still exceeded the general inflation. So we spend between 5 and 6% a year. The growth in health spending is between 5 and 6% a year. The consumer price index or the general inflation is between 2 and 3% a year. So if you think about that in a graph, you can see that healthcare spending grows faster than general inflation. So dollars over time can buy less and less. And so in order to do that, you have to raise premiums. What the Medicaid expansion, we don't know yet. We know the Medicaid expansion helps the bottom line for hospitals, particularly safety net hospitals like the University of Virginia, where I work, because it gives a revenue stream to people. It gives people health insurance, which they then can use when they go to the hospital or the emergency room to help pay their medical bills. Without the Medicaid expansion, UVA still has uninsured folks in the coverage gap who show up, get care, and can't pay for it. And so we have to write it off as bad debt. We have to go back to the state and try to get some money from the state to defray those costs. We don't know yet if the Medicaid expansion actually improves health to the point that it's a significant savings in the overall healthcare spending. We know it helps hospitals. We know it helps individuals. We know uninsured people use about half of the healthcare that fully insured people do, and we know that uninsured people enter the healthcare system much sicker and die earlier. But do we know that the Medicaid expansion actually saves money over time? We don't know that.
A few minutes left with our guest, Carolyn Engelhard. She is the director of the health policy program at UVA School of Medicine. Carolyn, politics, just a little bit about politics in the last little bit of time here. Kentucky elected a new governor who said that he is going to change, reduce Medicaid expansion. I think 400,000 people in Kentucky.
Yeah.
I'm curious as to what you might be aware of, other legal ways that he can do that. And I'm curious in a political sense of, have I missed something? Did I roll my eyes and fall over too early to hear him say what he would do instead to provide health insurance for these 400,000 people? Or is he just going to say, sorry, I don't like the way that's being done, you know, jerk the rug out from under you, and now you're back on your own. I don't care what happens to you health-wise.
Yeah, great question. First of all, let me say I grew up in Kentucky. I'm from Louisville, the land of fast horses, good whiskey, and beautiful women. Or we could change those adjectives around. But anyway, I have been following that election closely. You know, Mario Cuomo once said that campaigning is poetry and governing is prose. People who are running for elected office will say anything to get elected. And national surveys have taught us repeatedly that Obamacare is not very popular. So it's a very smart thing to do to campaign against Obamacare. But and what's so crazy is that the very folks in Kentucky that benefited from the Medicaid expansion and from they had a, their own state exchange called Connect, KY is Kentucky Connect. The very people who benefited from the Medicaid expansion and from their local exchange came in the out of the exit polls saying they voted for the Republican candidate because they always voted Republican. In essence, shooting themselves in the foot, but they didn't connect the dots. Now, Politics 101 is that once you give the people a benefit, you are loath to take it away. So, but I said to you earlier, poor people don't vote. So all of these different data points and variables go into this cauldron we call politics, economics, and so forth. I think what the governor of Kentucky will do is he's already started to backpedal. He's already said that he will not take away insurance from anyone who currently has it. He said he might disable the state exchange, which means the citizens of Kentucky will go up to the federal exchange like 34 other states do.
And so he, so the Kentucky would become part of Obamacare.
Yeah.
Is that what he's saying?
Yeah, but Kentucky is already part of Obamacare. It's just that they have a state exchange instead of a federal exchange. So they could just get rid of the state exchange. People could go to the federal exchange. That's not that big of a change. But what he is going to do, which might get him some political traction and also save his butt, is that he will ask Health and Human Services, HHS, to allow Kentucky to have the kind of Medicaid expansion that looks more like private insurance, which is more palatable to conservative voters and thinkers because it's less government, more private insurance. That is threading the needle, and he might be able to pull it off.
I just don't under. I've never understood how people can say things like, you know, these people. I don't want them to have. You know, I don't understand this thing with health insurance. I don't understand Obamacare. It's just they're. These are people in need. How can we not provide or come up with a way to give homes to people? How can we not provide programs to provide food for those who are hungry? How can we not work to come up with methods to offer health insurance or health care to those who can't otherwise find it on their own?
Well, and it's... Well, I appreciate what you're saying, and what I if I can leave your listeners, if there's anyone out there, with anything as we leave, is that we have laws in this country that do protect people from getting so that they do get health care. It may be in a very inefficient ways. For instance, you can walk into any emergency room in this country and you will get care. The question becomes, how do we pay for it? We pay for it in a variety of ways. What is the best way to pay for it so that we're both compassionate and cost effective?
Carolyn Englehart, just, you know, one last bit of information that I want you, and we've talked about a variety of different things. What's something that you want people to know? Because it's a sign-up time. The penalty will begin, will change. I've asked questions about being the employer, the Kentucky governor. Is there something here that we didn't get to that you had on your list that you wanted to make sure we talked about?
Well, I would just like for people out there to know that there are resources. Certainly, if you know someone who doesn't have health insurance, I'm on the board of our local free clinic. We have counselors at the free clinic that will work with people to help sign them up or at least give them information about the ACA and how to get health insurance. I would just ask people to try to think about this in a way that's less political and more, maybe as Rick has suggested, in a more compassionate way. We all, none of us want our neighbors to be unable to get decent health care. The question is, how do we pay for it? That's an ongoing national discussion. But in the meantime, there are resources out there to help people get health insurance so that our neighbors and family members in need don't have to go without health care if they need it.
Carolyn, thank you so much. And we'll see if we on the podcast post, we can put a link to all that. Carolyn Engelhardt, you can find her at the UVA School of Medicine, Director of the Health Policy Program. Sean McCord will be here for me next week. Everyone have a great day.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.